In the movie Chef, a father slowly loses everything in his life. Once a star up, a rising star in the cooking world, he relocates with his family from Miami to the opposite end of the country in Los Angeles. And slowly but surely, his life melts down. First, his marriage falls apart. Then, in the wake of his failed marriage, he struggles to maintain a relationship with his son. They mostly see each other every other weekend, and the whole time they're together, the father is thinking about all of the things he has to do after his son is gone. So their relationship really just becomes about whatever fun thing that they do. And at the same time, his son, who just wants to know his dad, suffers also. Finally, he has a spectacular meltdown that's caught on video and goes viral. And even his career is in tatters. The movie is about how he put his life back together and become a different person. And it begins as he starts a new journey professionally. It also begins with a new phase or a new attempt that he makes in his relationship with his son to have something that is real that they can share. And he does that by sharing what he does, what he loves with his boy. Here's this clip.
Hey, Bob, all day around, I got the four right here.
Behind you.
I want John. Good.
I got two right back here.
Two here.
System sounds like, but hey, I got a cousin who knows a guy who hooks us up with all our musical necessities.
Yeah, my credit cards are maxed out, and we're not charging for food yet, so we got to wait on the sound system.
Yeah, but you look happy, baby, don't you?
So happy.
Yeah, that's what something is.
I got one.
Whoa. That's burnt.
So? They're not paying for it?
Uh-oh, man. Get off the truck. You got this?
Yeah, I got it. Do your thing.
Slow down for a second. Is this boring to you?
No, I like it.
Yeah, well, I love it. Everything that's good that's happened to me in my life came because of that. I might not do everything great in my life. Okay, I'm not perfect. I'm not the best husband. And I'm sorry if I wasn't the best father. But I'm good at this. And I want to share this with you. I want to teach you what I learned. I get to touch people's lives with what I do. And it keeps me going, and I love it. And I think if you give it a shot, you might love it too.
Yes, sir.
Now, should we have served that sandwich?
No, chef.
That's my son. Get back in there with some hungry people. He's ready to cook.
Pretty soon, as they work together, instead of always looking for the moment that his son would go back to his mother's place, the relationship continues to deepen to the point where father and son become very bonded.
Hey, Mom! Where are you?
I'm in Austin!
Are you okay?
I'm great!
How's your daddy?
Can't talk to him.
Hi, Nez.
Hi, do you want me to come pick him up?
No, you're 1,000 miles away.
It's okay, I can go get on a plane and pick him up.
No, it's fine.
I miss him. I wanted you to come home. I love him.
He's fine. He's got a couple of burns and 2 stitches from a paring knife.
Hey, please, I'm serious. Let me go and pick him up.
You know your son's a cook now?
I'm a line cook.
He's a line cook.
Be careful.
I'll have him home in time for school.
It looks here like you guys are having so much fun.
All right, give me 1 second. Do you know your son could work a grill?
I had beer.
What is that?
He says he misses you.
I tell him I love him.
It's one of my favorite movies because it follows this. I think that the key character, the chef, that he kind of stumbles upon a pathway that is important for every one of us as we seek to navigate what our lives mean right now and what kind of legacy we want to leave in the future. Every other part of this series called Obituary deals with something, some sort of section in the obituary. Just to reiterate, most of us don't write our own obituary after we die. It's our family and our friends who collaborate together to describe what our life meant and what it was about. And so this is a series which is kind of walk through a typical obituary and its parts and thinking about family and work. And next week we're going to be talking about your officiant, who officiates your service and the faith community that they come from. So we'll talk about that next week. But this week we're not talking specifically about something that gets printed. It's something that is acknowledged by the people in your life that cannot be described often with words. On this Sunday, which is World Communion Sunday, where congregations like ours all over the world have been taking communion, are taking communion, and will be taking communion as we join together in this one unit, this one act of solidarity together. We think about what the offer of that meal means and this pathway in life that Jesus is seeking to give to us and that we seek to replicate. I have this family, and theirs was more of a typical story than you would know. The father had died years before, the mother had passed away, and the siblings were in the process of splitting up the estate, whatever financial assets there were, and then whatever furniture and other items were left that were owned by their parents. And two brothers both had their eyes on the same item. It was a rollaway desk. And so the day came when the family was supposed to gather together in the house, and they were supposed to make the decision, the two sisters and the two brothers, as to who would get what. And three of the four gathered together, the one brother intent on getting there and making his case for having this desk go with him to his house. And the other brother was late. And as they began to talk about who was going to get what, in the middle of the conversation, the other brother showed up with four other guys. They just went in, grabbed the desk, over yelling and screaming and shouting, took it and left. The two brothers then didn't talk for more than 25 years. I'm here to tell you that I've done enough funerals in my life to know that there are almost as many funerals where there are people who refuse to sit with one another in the room as there are those that are harmonious and loving. I've even had funerals where people have said they would refuse to come because of something that the deceased had done in their life, or because there was some sort of division that existed between siblings or between aunts and uncles. And so they just couldn't even fathom being in the same room together. It's just kind of cemented for me the idea that every family needs a peacemaker. Every family needs at least one person who has the necessary wisdom and the necessary presence, and dare I say, spiritual depth, to be able to help get everybody else on the same page, particularly in seasons when there is division. I I've witnessed this over and over, and when these particular people die, the service is different. When the family gathers together, there's always grieving. There's something a little bit extra. I don't know, a little more emotion, a little more attachment, gratitude, a greater value that's raised, a sense that something, someone that has something unique has been lost. You want to be able to leave this legacy to your family. You want to be the person who doesn't create drama, but the person that helps settles it. Won't get written in any obituary. But the presence of Jesus felt in your presence is a gift that every family needs. And I think Jesus gives us a good pathway as to how this would happen. Just setting the scene for John 21, we need to remember that Peter has failed Jesus spectacularly. Peter, who has already been asked by Jesus to become the leader of his community, of his movement, this new kingdom that was happening, Peter, who's already been told by Jesus, commissioned by him, to be the leader of this church of his on earth, after he's gone, Peter has failed. Now, admittedly, Jesus told Peter he was going to fail. When they were together for their Last Supper, for their communion, when they all gathered at the table, Jesus said that there were going to be two people in the room, one who was going to betray him, Judas, and the other who was going to deny him, Peter. And Peter protested loudly. He was very upset that Jesus would have so little faith in him. He had shown so much leadership. He had grown so much over the course of their three-year journey. He just couldn't believe that Jesus would think this little of him. But sure enough, later that night, as the Sanhedrin debated what Jesus' fate was going to be in a kangaroo court, when Peter was recognized out in the court outside of the chief priest Caiaphas' house, when he's recognized, he denies on three separate occasions that he even knows who Jesus is. And so John, the author of John, thinks so much of this story that he makes sure that it is included in his text, and it's part of the conclusion. It's really the conclusion of his testimony to who Jesus was and is. And so the first thing about the story that moves me, that I think we need to pay attention to, is Jesus' generosity. So the disciples, Jesus has risen from the dead. He's appeared to the disciples many times, but there's still some work left to be done. He knows that there's still work left to be done. And so the disciples know who Jesus is after a long night of catching nothing. They figure out who Jesus is when all of a sudden their nets are filled with 153 fish. What's the significance of 153? Normally, I would spend at least 5 minutes on a sermon talking about numerology in the Old and New Testament, but in this particular case, I don't have any clue. Doesn't seem to be any significance per se to the number 153. It's just to let us know that that's a lot of fish. If you had a friend that went out to the reservoir and went fishing and they came back and they said they had caught 153 fish and you asked where they were and he said that he threw them all back, what would you think? you would think that he was a fisherman, right? Telling stories like only fishermen can tell. So it's this abundance, this generosity, that's how the disciples in the morning know that it's Jesus on the shore. And then they have breakfast with him. He has everything ready for breakfast. Man, what would it be like to have breakfast with Jesus? What would it be like to have breakfast with Jesus every day? The disciples, for the most part, for 3 years, spend all of their time with their rabbi and their teacher, and they watch him in everything that he does. They pay attention when he teaches and he preaches and he prays, and when he sits them down and offers him another bit of his wisdom. But they're also watching him when he's just doing mundane things to try and learn something. How many times had they eaten breakfast with Jesus? How many times had the master done the cooking? Generosity. The disciples know Jesus through his generosity. We know when Jesus is present. We know when the Spirit is at work. When generosity is working, when generosity is present, when somebody offers us what it is that they're able to offer us. They may not be the richest person in the world. The two brothers had a sister, two sisters, and one of the two sisters was an incredible baker. As a matter of fact, her specialty was a form of a caramel apple pie. I know that it was delicious because she would make them for the staff at the church every so often. And before I knew her, I weighed 110 pounds. Fisherman's story, right? But in all truth, I mean, she was an incredible baker, and her pies were prized by people in the community and in our congregation and in her family. And so when she would call you and tell you that she had baked a pie, it usually meant it, one, you wanted to go because the pie was delicious. But one of the things that you learned when she would do this was that there was something that she wanted to talk about. One time when she invited me over for pie, she let me know that she and her husband were giving a missionary friend of ours a pickup truck in Haiti and wanted to find out how to make that happen. She was just that kind of person. And so one day she called her two brothers and informed them that there was going to be pie at her house, and they both needed to be there. And there was no that would be accepted to her invitation. People of gratitude give what they have. Following in the footsteps of Jesus. Jesus is a king who doesn't die with a big bank account in Switzerland or the Cayman Islands. He's not a king who, when he dies, has palaces and magnificent homes all over the world. Jesus, who is God incarnate on earth, think about all that means. Jesus gives away what he has. He's generous. And so we're called to give away what we have, to figure out how to manage our lives. That's tougher when we're young. But as we get older, as we begin to develop some disciplines in terms of how we manage our finances and our time and our resources, we begin to understand that anything that can be offered up and given away is valued. And when we make that a cornerstone of our life, then we're beginning to understand that we're following in the steps of Jesus. When people say, "Pastor, I'm just not getting anything out of church anymore. When I leave, I feel empty. I'm just not getting anything. I say, "Well, maybe that means that God's got you in a place where you're ready to begin to move from milk to meat, and he wants you to give yourself away." know. But generosity, this pathway toward becoming the kind of person who is a peacemaker, begins with generosity. And it doesn't stop there. A person who is a peacemaker is one who's all about restoration. Jesus had met with the disciples multiple times. You would think that breakfast with Jesus would be enough after they had seen one another over and over again, many times after the ascension. But Jesus understood that there was this one thing that was left to be done. One thing that needed to be completed. And so, there at the seaside, he asks Peter three times, "Do you love me?" Doesn't ask him once. I mean, once you would think would be enough, right? You think that would be enough, but Jesus gets what's going on in Peter's heart, and he also understands what's going on in the hearts of all the other disciples. Here is the leader who has failed magnificently, not just in the eyes of his master, but in the eyes of those he's supposed to lead. And because Peter denies him three times, Jesus asks him three times, "Peter, do you love me?" He wants to restore Peter inside in his heart and soul. He doesn't want that sense of failure to overcome him. He wants to use this moment to create greater empathy and a greater sense of direction and love inside of Peter. But at the same time, he wants to use this opportunity to knit Peter and the disciples together. One almost got away over there. You see lights flashing off and on? And if it seems kind of warm in here, and it just seems like things are a little unusual today, it's because a big limb fell on our power line last night. We didn't get power back till about 4 o'clock this morning. So I apologize for that. I was going to explain it, and I forgot. I was so hungry to get into this sermon this morning. Because we need people of generosity, and we need people who look to restore others. The two brothers sit down at the table, and they're eating pie. They haven't been at the same table for 25 years. They're saying positively, absolutely nothing. Their older sister is sitting there eyeing them. She's made sure that they've had a generous piece cut for them, and they've had a couple of scoops of vanilla ice cream each. And then she just asked the question, "When's this gonna stop?" When's this going to stop? She'd been diagnosed with leukemia. She'd been taking treatments for 6 years, and there was nothing left to do. When's this going to stop? And the brother who took the desk began to weep. Many times, he said, he had wanted to call the other brother and apologize. Many times, he wanted to bury the hatchet. He couldn't, you know, he had lost count of all the Christmases and family reunions and Easters and 4th of Julys and graduations and funerals and weddings, where there was this pall of uncertainty that hung over the family because of their broken relationship. He just felt too much pride and too much shame all at the same time to say anything. People who have that intangible quality that can't be described in an obituary, they're people of generosity, but they're also people of restoration, so that they can help refocus us. So Peter, you know, Jesus says to Peter, "Listen, man, if you thought what you experienced what you experienced outside of Caiaphas' house, out in the garden, if you thought that was rough, by following me, you're sealing your own fate. By taking this job, by doing what it is that I've asked you to do, it's going to cost your life. In Roman Catholicism, it is believed that the tomb of Peter is deep underneath the Vatican. I had a Bible professor in seminary. We were part of a consortium of theological schools in Columbus, Ohio. I went to the Methodist school, and we had a relationship with the Lutheran school and the Catholic school that was right down the road. And Father Bauer was the professor of Hebrew and Greek, Old and New Testament at the school, and he was wildly popular on our campus. He was a fantastic instructor. I took most of my upper level Bible with him. Enjoyed him immensely. While he was earning his doctorate living in Vatican City, he used to give tours of the Vatican. It was one of his jobs that he had while he was there. And he would describe to us the tomb of Peter. Is it really Peter's remains? I would ask Father Bauer, and he would look at me, and his eyes would twinkle, and he would say, "Well, that's what the Pope says." But the legend of Peter's death was that he was crucified upside down because he did not feel worthy of being crucified in the same way as his master. He asked to die inverted. Terrible way to die. And we don't know if that's true either, but when we read the epistles, we know that Peter was jailed and he was whipped, and we know that he had to run out of town in the middle of the night to save his skin, and we know that the journey, there was division among the apostles. It was not an easy journey. He has to live through the fall of Jerusalem and the death of thousands. That is seared in his memory. As he leaves that place and reportedly goes to Rome, where the center of the church begins to take shape, refocus. Sometimes we major in the minors. I feel that way about my denomination right now. That's what I told the group that came to our study talking about the future of the United Methodist Church, trying to explain central conferences and mission conferences and annual conferences and this plan and that plan, and is our denomination going to stay together or is it not going to stay together? What's the role of the pension plan and all this? Blah, 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 blah. Bruce Reinhardt, lovely, lovely man, goes to first service, raises his hand. He said, "Isn't this just supposed to be about people giving their lives to Jesus?" Refocused. The brothers were sitting at the table. It was the first that they knew of their sister's pending death. They embraced one another. The desk had been in the one brother's possession for so long that they just came up with another way to be able to make things right. At that point, it really didn't make any difference, but the first thing the brothers did was pull the family together and have a celebration of their sister, where that pall of uncertainty was no longer operable, because people could see them together, embracing one another, loving one another. And I know this story because they told it to me when I did her funeral. These are the kinds of stories you want told. May never make it into an obituary. But these are the stories you want told about you after you die. Stories of generosity, restoration, and refocus on what's important. All starts with breakfast with Jesus, friends. It all starts. You can stumble on it like the chef does, or you can go seek it in the presence of the living God. Breakfast with Jesus, spending time in His Word, praying and listening in prayer, gathering together to draw the most out of one another, not hesitating to offer your worship and praise to the living God. Starts with breakfast with Jesus till His presence becomes so familiar, so recognizable in your life that it becomes recognizable to others.